From Blues Point Power to the Australian Embassy in Paris, from Rose Sidler House to Australia Square Tower, from Brisbane's Riverside Centre to the Ian Thorpe Aquatic Centre in Ultimo in Sydney, Harry Sidler's architectural vision has impacted upon our lives for decades. Some love it, others hate it. Most of us not realising just quite how much his designs have shaped the way we live, work and play. As a teenager, he escaped 1930s Austria and Nazi Germany. He arrived in Australia in 1948. He saw it then as a backwater, but he went on to recast our architecture. Helen O'Neill is the author of a new biography of Harry Sidler. It's called A Singular Vision, Harry Sidler, and she joins me in the breakfast studio. Helen, welcome again to breakfast.
Thank you for having me.
You take on the big ones. Harry Sidler, he was devoted almost religiously, I think it's fair to say, to modernism. That was his singular vision. Do you trace where the passion for modernism came from?
Absolutely, and I think with a character like Harry, it's essential to do that. He was the product of some of the most traumatic events in the 20th century. He was actually a child internee himself. He was locked up by the British indefinitely, and when the Australians began doing this, he spoke out against it very passionately, talking about it in terms of torture, saying any politician that did this should themselves be locked up. By the time he'd got to Australia, he'd managed to seek out some significant figures in modernism. He'd been trained in Harvard by Walter Gropius, who was the founder of the Bauhaus. And he bought the things he'd learnt, the things he'd seen. He came via South America, where he made sure that he spent time with Oscar Niemeyer, another enormous figure in modernist culture. He brought all this to Australia and landed in this country like an asteroid hitting the earth. The ripples, I think, are still felt today.
I think that's fair to say. But as you say, he was there. He knew these people who were at the centre of modernism and modernist building, structural building in particular. How did he get from those internment camps? How did he get from, you know, just escaping Nazi persecution of the Jews in the late 30s to be mixing it with some of the world's great architects and starting to emerge himself?
It's such an interesting question, this. You have to look, I mean, one of the things about Harry Sidler is I wished I'd had the opportunity to meet him as a child. When he was in the internment camps, the British locked up so many people. They were locking up academics, Cambridge academics, many different kinds of extraordinarily bright and well-regarded people. Harry actually used the internment camp as a kind of university, a proto-university, and he was interned in Britain. Then many of these internees were moved to different Commonwealth countries. He was interned in Canada. He managed to
get. And how old was he in the internment camps?
He was interned at the age of 16. He was released at the age of 18, and he was released in order to take an architecture degree at the University of Manitoba in Canada. They had agreed to take, there was a system underway whereby some of the younger people, some of the people who were interned, could get out if they managed to get in to some kind of degree. And Harry's intellect and really kind of fierce determination at that point was to do this. He'd already decided that architecture was for him. But then you have another step. From the degree he did in Canada, he then realised, became entranced by modernism, and made sure that he went on to do a master's degree at Harvard under Walter Gropius. And what happened at this point is interesting too. Harry would describe this as it really opened his eyes. He embraced modernism as a philosophy, as a methodology, and became almost evangelical about it. So when he left Gropius, he then started working with Marcel Breuer, another Bauhaus master. He then, as I said, went to South America to work with one of the enormous figures of modernism, Niemeyer, and brought this to Australia, a place he was never intending to spend very long in at all.
No, he didn't want to come to Australia. He came because he wanted to help build or to build his parents' a house. So he was a dutiful son. It was kind of very much against his grain. We now know that house. It's Rose Sidler House. And that changed the way Australians saw housing.
It did. It's hard to kind of think about it today, but Rose Sidler House really did. He, I mean, Harry hit the ground running here. And as I say, he didn't...
Well, he wanted to get in and out quickly.
That he wanted to get plan. In and out quickly. He'd come to do a sort of favour for his parents. His mother knew the perfect lure, and it was to offer him his first commission. And she gave him carte blanche. So he created this object in the Australian bush, which was elevated, had floor-to-ceiling glass walls. It spoke to its environment in a way that hadn't been attempted in quite such a fashion before. This is not to say that there were not modern architects in Australia, and again, not to say that many of them were doing very interesting work. But Harry's approach brought something entirely new. It brought the Bauhaus, it brought a level of determination, and it also brought, I think, for him an element of surprise. Because what he found when he came here was that there wasn't just one person happy to take his work, a young architect. There were many, many people, and so these housing commissions started to spread. And within a few years, he had so many, he just didn't feel there was any point going back to America.
For him, it was very much the land of opportunity. He said that he regarded architecture as art, not building. He described how new techniques meant architecture was about space, not mass. This was very much the philosophy he injected, as you say, into Australian houses. He had all these commissions. But housing wasn't his only commission, and one of his most famous and loved and loathed, I think, buildings was the Blues Point Tower, his first skyscraper, I guess you could call it. Many people regard it as a blight on Sydney Harbour. What do you think of it?
I don't have this big adverse reaction to the tower itself. I think as a structure, it's an interesting object. And when you look at what Harry was attempting to do with it visually, within the limitations that he was set, which were quite extreme, It's an interesting creative object. Where it's placed is another matter entirely. And one thing I've learnt whilst doing this book is that across the span of architecture, there are objects that are very difficult for anybody to handle. And the saddest object of all, it would seem, is a tower standing alone.
On a harbour.
On a harbour,
and yes. It was the harbour he loved. I mean, the harbour was one of the things that persuaded him to love Australia.
Indeed, indeed. You would have to ask today, would this be allowed? I think the answer would probably be no, and the reasons would be set out clearly. There would be a debate. Blues Point Tower, when you look at the how this all unfolded, happened very quickly. The architect took on the project, yes. But is the architect responsible for where this building is?
Probably not.
Probably not.
It's 23 minutes to nine on Breakfast. Our guest, 28 minutes, I beg your pardon. Our guest is Helen O'Neill. She's the author of the new autobiography of Harry Seidler. It's called A Singular Vision. In terms of that vision, he was a contributor to society beyond just building the houses. If you look at probably talking about the harbour and architecture upon it, the most famous or the 20th century Australian architectural achievement is the Sydney Opera House, and the debacle was the sacking of Utzon. Harry Seidler was a very strong campaigner for Johan Utzon, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. And the relationship between Seidler and the Opera House is a fascinating one that actually predates the Utzon campaign that we all know about in the 60s when everyone was fighting so hard to keep Utzon in. In the late 1950s, Australia decided to build an opera house. It was wonderful. There was a competition. There's a famous story about Eero Saarinen, the jurist, arriving to this competition as a judge. He arrived late. He went through the discarded entries and picked one out. And this was Utzon's. And then the story
from the discard
goes,
pile.
From the discard stuff. This is how the story goes. And he then convinced his fellow judges that this was the one. This was it. Now, there's a question in my mind. What was Saarinen doing here? Obviously, he was invited to become a juror. At that time, Harry Seidler was a figure who he was reaching out internationally. He knew Saarinen. A colleague of his remembers Harry Seidler fighting to make sure that Saarinen was on this jury. Saarinen arrives. Utzon wins. Nobody knows who Utzon is here, but Harry Seidler knew. He had a book of Utzon's work. He knew exactly who he was. And he was a divisive and interesting figure at that time. The press went straight to Harry because Harry's was one of those entries that had been beaten. They wanted to know what he thought. He immediately described this. He saw it. He saw what it could be from these drawings that didn't seem to work.
So he wanted it to get pulled out of that discard pile.
He knew what it was.
You talk about, let's go to the legacy of Harry Seidler, which of course remains in buildings around the country. But he is a divisive figure. You said that again. How do other architects, by and large, regard Harry Seidler? Some of the public love or hate his buildings, but what about architects?
I couldn't speak for architects. I'm not an architect writer. I would imagine that the scope of reaction is broad, as it was during the Utzon campaign, this split architecture. And there are architects to this day, such as Glenn Murcutt, who still absolutely adore Harry Seidler for the stand he took, the stand for Utzon, for creativity, for being allowed to see a vision through to completion. And as we all know, the Opera House as a vision, now that it is through to completion, was something, it's had an enormous impact.
And he didn't do it on his own. I mean, he had supporters. He had supporters like, for instance, Dick Dusseldorf, also from Eurobohem background, from Lend-Lease. Together they, as a team, worked on changing the face of Sydney. So there were other partners with Harry all through, not to mention, of course, his wife Penelope.
Absolutely. One of the really fascinating things about this is the collaborations that he embarked upon. A key one was with Dick Dusseldorp, who went on to found Lend-Lease, who was a very interesting, significant figure who changed a lot of things. Now, Harry Seidler, in the building of Australia Square, which was a landmark building in every way in Sydney for Australia, for the Southern Hemisphere, you might say.
Not simply because it was curved, not simply because of that.
No, because what it came to represent was the stepping of Australia into modernity. It was the highest lightweight concrete building of its kind in the world once constructed. It brought in the expertise of Pierluigi Nervi, known as the Picasso of concrete. It contained, because Harry Seidler said it should, public art brought in from overseas that was galleried out in full view of the public. So Harry Seidler managed to put developers in a situation where they were being forced to pay for art that we can all still see and enjoy as part of a private development. Very, very unusual.
There is so much to this story. Helen O'Neill, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Helen O'Neill and her book, A Singular Vision, Harry Seidler, is published by HarperCollins. And I should say that a good part of the book does go to his relationship, his working and private and emotional relationship with his wife, Penelope Seidler. It's obviously instrumental to his success. It's 22 to 9 on Breakfast.